Sam Hamill's the author of 14 volumes of original poetry, has published 3 collections of essays and 24 volumes translated from ancient Greek, Latin, Estonian, Japanese, and Chinese. The founding editor of Copper Canyon Press and the director of Poets Against War, his work has been translated into more than 12 languages, and the latest book is Measured by Stone. Sam just gave a reading at Doe Bay last night, and basically read from this and new work, the Habitation series, which has not yet been published. I mean, not yet been published in a book form that
in
you can
trade use. Form.
In trade form. That's
if
the.
If you've got a spare $10,000 lying around, I got a book for you.
Yeah. Have you ever? I don't think you've ever told that story about Ian Boyd, and you told it last night, and we recorded the reading last night, so people can refer to the recording. But maybe you could talk a little bit about meeting Ian Boyd and what he did with your work.
Well, I discovered his work at a AWP Book Fest in Vancouver, BC. And his wife told me that my work as poet, translator, printer had been one of his inspirations. And he's a studio artist, a painter, scholar of Chinese, and a remarkable artist bookmaker. And I wrote the first of the trilogy called Habitations. It's basically an ekphrastic poem honoring his unique process of using things like fossilized ear bone of whale ground up into the inks that he makes. Well, I was totally blown away by his work, and we met, and he sent me some catalog things, and I looked at some of his images, and I dedicated the first of the Habitations trilogy to him, which I thought was just going to be one poem. But I realized by the end of it that there had to be a couple of follow-up sections. So it's a trilogy that I dedicated to him because his work is so profound and so inspirational.
Crab Quill Press.
Crab Quill Press.
So you realize that this was it didn't end after the first series of poems. Tell us a little bit about that impulse that you recognize there's more to it here.
Well, sometimes you write something and you think, you know, I got it. And then you come back to it a week later and you realize, well, you know, this isn't really the end. This is a pause, but I have more to say in this way and in this style and in this voice. And if you're listening carefully to that voice, you follow your voice. I mean, you have to bow to your muse.
Yeah. This gets to a question I had been meaning to ask you for a while and get on tape about the difference between the epic tradition, which I don't know, we associate with Europe and America, and the serial tradition, which we associate more with a West Coast kind of sensibility, and what Robin Blazer and Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer talked about. So can you talk about the serial tradition and maybe how that's more of a West Coast thing than an East Coast or Midwest thing?
Well, it seems to be more prominent among a certain group of West Coast poets. The poem in sequence can be inspired in various ways. One of them is simply through lyrical form, which provides a kind of syntax which one begins to follow. And one returns to that music, to that language, with a certain ability to listen within yourself, and extend that rhythm, extend that kind of speech, extend the meditation, but not in a narrative way, which is necessary for the epic. The epic has to have a narrative base. And while there may be narrative impulses and shadows in the serial poem or the sequential poem, its root is not a narrative poem. Its root is shorter and more lyrical.
If there's a narrative thread, it's often one that develops organically and maybe outside the awareness of the poet writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Habitations has some of those elements of the serial poem, especially when we look at how you end with a phrase and then repeat with that phrase or something similar.
Well, I don't exactly repeat the phrase. I inexactly repeat the phrase, as Marvin Bell would say. You have to be careful about that sort of thing, or it can become simply a device. So, finding the measure, Robert Kelly has a wonderful poem by that title, Finding the Measure, is finding the mantram, is finding how to proceed. And it's inspirational. I mean, you have to listen to your muse. And the more you force things syntactically, the further away you tend to get from the truth of the poem, as it were.
When it's used as a device, maybe you could speak a little bit to the dangers of that, or what that reflects when something is being used as a device.
Well, that issue is the matter of artifice. Artifice can make a poem, and it can also destroy a poem. I think of that line from that wonderful George Seferis poem that I read last night, our art whose features have been eaten away by gold. We've loaded our poetry with so much music that it is slowly sinking. This idea that you can overload a work of art. So you don't want to load up. And each of us has a slightly different impulse. And it's being true to the impulse and being true to whatever your literary values, whatever your philosophical values are. In my case, in the poem Habitations, I was trying to connect in a very deep way with the ecology of the Northwest. And in each of the poems, there's a list of extinct animals and plants and things. Thinking about those things that have gone extinct, except that they are still within us. They're within us within the imagination, but they're also biologically within us. So it's organic poetry that's actually organic.
Well, it's interesting. I'm reminded of the indigenous people who say that, some scientists came and checked the genetics of a cedar tree and found bear or found salmon genes in it, because the bears eat the salmon, the bears shit the salmon, and the salmon genes become part of that tree.
Yeah.
Literally part
yeah.
of the tree. Yeah. So that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
What about the research to find these different extinct species? How was that?
Well, that's abundantly available. There's plenty of information online in any library about, you know, animal and plant and insect extinction. And I had read a lot about it over the many years, so I didn't really have to look much up. I mean, I did look up a few things. But mostly the things I mention are things that I've at one time or another studied. For instance, the Western camel. When you think about camels roaming Puget Sound, it sort of boggles the mind, you know. There were camels here.
Isn't that the fear of the average right-wing American? Camels will return and we'll have
I think it's the camel herders that they worry about.
So the camel jockeys. Right. There are some great images. I mean, just even saying the names and hearing them aloud, there's some great images of that. And you talk about the Fenopoeia, you know, just beautiful images that kind of gallop across your mind's eye when you hear that poem.
Yeah.
So when I think of...
Well, there's also a kind of Zen thusness in that. There's a really wonderful Zen koan that says, why is the white horse not a horse? So it's ways to pique the imagination and to try to engage the imagination and philosophy and history all at once.
And an ethos of responsibility.
Yeah, and an ethos, of course.
Of the human not being anthropocentric, but taking their rightful place in the great order of things.
Yes.
Yeah.